So our speaker this afternoon really needs no introduction. I'd like to present Chuck Spee from Laguna Beach.
Bonjour, I'm Chuck Spee, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi. I want to thank your committee for allowing me to share this occasion with you. And I want to thank you all for coming. There's an old boy named Buttermilk down south. And I thought I'd give our leader, our fearless leader, the way he introduced me down there at Hot Springs, Arkansas a couple of years ago. He says this has been a very productive and very interesting conference up until now. He says, I wonder if old Boober is going to mess it up. And then it's going to be. So that's what I'm wondering right now. If I'm going to mess it up. I said, my name is Chuck Spee and I'm an alcoholic. I'm neither proud of it nor am I ashamed of it. That's the way it is with me. I am an alcoholic. Something has to happen to an alcoholic before you can say that. It's rather interesting that when I was a practicing alcoholic, there's anyone out in this room that had called me an alcoholic, and I would have gotten up off the floor. I'd have kicked you right in the mouth if I could have seen you. That's something that nobody must know, not even me. And we went to any length to keep anybody from knowing it. So something has to happen to us before we can get up and say comfortably, I am an alcoholic. I'm rather unique in a way. I'm not different. I don't want to say that. But I'm rather unique in a way. And that is that I couldn't even investigate this program as long as I had the power of choice. As long as I had the power of choice, my choice was never to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I never came. Until I ran out of everything, including the power of choice. That happened to me in January 1946. The bottle finally killed me. It beat me into total and absolute nothingness. And I can say to you right now, without any compunction at all, that's the greatest single event that has ever happened in my life up until now, and I'm 70 years old. I didn't hear one of you say, ah. You know damn well I don't look like I was 70 years old. That's better. But isn't it strange that you could say again, very comfortably, that the greatest thing that's ever happened to you is when the bottle killed you? Because only then could I come and investigate Alcoholics Anonymous. I had analyzed me 10 years before coming to the program. Because I wasn't drinking well. I had had a code for drinking for 15 years. And I had drunk according to my code. And after 15 years, I wasn't drinking according to my code. And it bothered me. And I took inventory of myself. And I came up with the conclusion that this was a personal weakness. Something that I had to overcome to get rid of it. It never occurred to me that total abstinence was the answer. At that time, I thought that any weakling could quit drinking. But it took a pretty good man to meet this thing head on and beat it. And that's what I was going to do, and I set about to do just that. And I worked on my problem for the next 10 years very diligently. And the harder I worked, the worse it got, and the worse it got, the harder I worked. And the farther backwards I went, the greater was the obsession that I had to beat this deal. I was saying to myself, at least 5 years after everybody quit listening to me, I'll beat this thing if it's the last thing I ever do. And it came that close to being the last thing I ever did. Now, I think that it's pretty nearly right when we say to each other that it's almost impossible for the non-alcoholic mind to understand our antics as drinking alcoholics. I have 27 and a half years, roughly, to look over as a sober man without a drink or pill. I have 25 years of drinking to look over. And 19 years before that. And it's almost impossible for me, even now, to try to explain to myself what I did. Because, you see, I became periodic 10 years before coming to the program. I became periodic on purpose because I was going to win this battle. And you can't win, you can't even fight when you're down on your back. You have to get well enough to get back in the ring for the next round. And so for my last 10 years, between every two drinks, I was physically as sober as I am right now. And yet I got drunk again, and again, and again, and again, and again, and again. And it's almost impossible to try to explain that to me. Because I never had one good drunk in the last 10 years. Every one of them was worse than the one before. And yet I kept trying. I could look at my record with physically sober eyes. And by this time, I've accumulated a bit of a record, and I'm going to run through it very fast because I don't like to talk about that end of the business too much. Because the things that happen to me happen to everybody that drinks like I did. But first you get drunk, and then you get drunker, stay drunk longer. Then you get in a little trouble, mainly around the house and a little around the office. And then your trouble starts spreading, and eventually covers everything. And then maybe you'll start losing a little time. They call that a blackout. That scared the hell out of me when I had my first blackout. But it didn't scare me badly enough because I left to drink for nothing in the world but oblivion. Then you start having a little difficulty with the gendarmes. They capture you and detain you without your permission. Now this is difficult for me to understand. Because I never got to a place where I was comfortable in jail. Never did. I just come, don't like it, be jail. And I told my family that I loved it. I spent so much time there. Then I started having to get into trouble with fleas. I'd only run into 5 guys in 27 years that had the trouble with fleas I did. My bedroom had got 10 billion fleas in. And I'd lie there and try to scrape them off, and they'd roll over my hands. And I'd wear myself out trying to get rid of those fleas. And then you just got to lie there and breathe fleas. And that ain't good living, I tell you something. Then they turned into spiders about the size of this top of this podium, coming down from the ceiling, and you couldn't get out from under them. That's nerve-wracking. Really is. Eventually, I think I became probably the only man in Beverly Hills that was ever charged by a herd of elephants. That almost never happens in Beverly Hills. Then you start hearing music with no visible means of support. Many of you have heard this, but I've mentioned it, so I have to carry it through. I'll never forget the first time I heard the music. I was coming off with a pretty bad drunk, and I went to the kitchen to get a glass of buttermilk. The teakettle was sitting on the stove, and the steam coming out, you know. And along with this steam came the most beautiful symphony I ever heard in my life. And I took it big. I thought, this is the greatest phenomenon of modern times. This old teakettle has suddenly become a receiving set. And I went out and herded the family and to listen to music. They didn't hear nothing, and I thought they were nuts. I loved to hear a dozen bands at once, and all of them with different announcers, and lots of good music, but you couldn't turn it off. Came out of peculiar places. Come out of the lights, out of the shower, out of the toilet. Any place. Couldn't turn it off. Then I started having a little trouble with people. I'd meet the people and talk to them, and it seemed like there was nobody there. I think this was probably the most difficult thing that my family had to put up with. Because oftentimes, we'd all be in the same living room, and I'd have company, and they wouldn't talk to me. And a little later, you start waking up with cuts and bruises and black eyes and tongue about that thick, all full of holes. We call that an alcoholic convulsion. Now, I could look at that record right up until my last drink and come up with the profound conclusion. This time it's going to be different. Now, how in the hell can you do that when you're looking at a deal like that with physically sober eyes? But right up until my last drink, that is the way it was with me. This time it's going to be different. I've learned my lesson. And, of course, it always was. It was worse, just like the last time. But that wasn't what I thought. Up until my last drink, it was never my fault that I drank. Now, this is another thing that's impossible to explain. It was never my fault. It looks to me like if a guy drank for 25 years, that once it'll be his fault. You know, just once. But it never was my fault until my last drink. It's your fault. If you mean stupid people that live like I knew you should, and like I told you how, I wouldn't have had to get drunk. But you wouldn't do it. So I got drunk at you. My wife was a real good reason for me to get drunk. She didn't love me enough. She didn't understand me. But as good as she was, her mother was much better than she. There was a perfect reason to get drunk. This gal only had one child, and I was married to her. And she was living with us. She had a grandstand seat watching me crucify her in the bathroom. And she didn't like me very good. And I didn't like her that good. Because, you see, if she hadn't been there, I wouldn't have had to crucify her daughter. We had a mutual holding society that was perfect. It's a beautiful thing to see. But whilst I'm on the subject, I'd like to tell you that she lived with us 5 years after I sobered up. And it's absolutely amazing what this program did for her. I don't see to come in the last year that she lived. And found me slapping that only daughter of hers all over the living room. She would have said, "Why, Elsa, what have you done?" Because by this time I could be no long in here. Fact, and I'll tell you this one little thing more and hurry along. She used to embarrass me worse than anybody that I've ever known in the 27 years. Because she never would believe that anybody, God or anybody else, had anything to do with this but me. She'd come up and put her arms around me and she'd say, "Oh, son, I knew you. I knew you." But then kill me. I'd start blushing at my toenails and go right out the top of my head. She wouldn't believe it. She knew I did it all by myself. It's almost impossible to dream up a reason that would keep us doing this. Of course, you and I know that we were doing the best we could with what we had. We didn't know any better. We had to do what we did. Thank God we found that out. If I didn't have the one and only one word that covers that kind of ethics to hang on to, I wouldn't be yourself me. And that word is insanity. You and I might be perfectly sane in all the other areas of our lives, but if we'd be alcoholic, so far as alcohol is concerned, we are insane. And that makes it possible for us to get up here and talk. We were doing the best we could according to our light, that is, according to our understanding. Now I'm going to tell you a little about my last go-round. On the Friday before Christmas, 1945, my boss called me in. And he said, "Charlie," I was Charlie and Baby. He said, "You've had a lot of trouble this year." Now, he didn't mention alcohol, but he knew that I knew what he meant when he said trouble. And being a non-alcoholic, you ought to figure it out. He says, "I think I know the reason for it. I think it's because of pressure is on you. And I'm going to take a little pressure off of you. And instead of shooting me, as he had every right to do, he gave me $2,000 for a Christmas present." That was the Friday before Christmas, 1945. Now, if any of you have ever drunk any liquor, you know that there's one thing in an alcoholic's life that's worse than bad fortune, and that's good fortune. So, I had a reprieve, so I got drunk on the way home. Now, this was not far from the curse for me, because periodics don't get drunk in a hurry. Periodics never taper off. We always taper on. We have a regular routine. We come off the drunk and go on the health kick. We get real busy building the old body back up. We eat well, sleep well, drink a lot of milk, eat vitamins in the buckets, exercise. And when we get everything back where it belongs physically. Then they analyze the last drunk. And they see what we did wrong. We see where we made our mistakes. And we decide not to do it that way anymore. And then we get that lined out, and we start sampling. And we sample away at them back to bed. But not in a hurry. Usually it took me in a place from 60 to 90 days to get off my feet. I always made it. But it took a while. But this time I got drunk on the way home. And the next 4 weeks, I knew nothing about it. Christmas came and went, New Year's came and went, and the first 2 or 3 weeks in January came and went. And I didn't know that they had been. Best I can figure, I had 4 weeks of blackout. Getting the clock around in bed. 4 weeks. I never ate when I drank, so I had nothing in my body but whiskey. And what I came to sometime after the middle of January was the clearest head I've ever known in my entire lifetime. This is a strange thing, too. However, in the last many years, many priests, preachers, and doctors have told me that it isn't uncommon for a person who is actually dying to have a little period of sanity. And if they make the right decision, they come back. And if they make the wrong decision, they go ahead and die. I don't know anything about that, but I know what happened to me. I came out of this period with the clearest head I've ever known. And for the first time in my life, I knew that I'd lost the battle of life. I had never in my life, in 42 years, I had never admitted defeat. Not to God, man, woman, or the devil. But that morning I knew that I'd lost. I didn't know why, because I knew nothing of the disease of alcoholism. But I knew that I had lost the battle of life. I knew why my wife was divorcing me after 25 years. 20 years at that time. And I knew why my kids wouldn't come home when I was around. And I knew why this same boss had sent word to the house that if I ever stepped foot in the plant again, he was going to send me through the window. I accepted the fact that morning that everything dear to me in life is gone and should be gone. And that I was not entitled to have it back. But I'm going to say that again because it's on this that my new life was built. I totally and completely accepted the fact that everything dear to me in life is gone and should be gone, and that I was not entitled to have it back. And it became very necessary at that moment for me to be sober till I died. Not because I wanted sobriety for me. I did not. I didn't want anything for me. My life is over, and I knew it. I'd come that close to dying the next to the last time out. And this was worse. So I knew I was going to die. I didn't care. But I must have the time between now and when I died to rub out as much of the record as I could rub out before I kicked off. I didn't want Mrs. C and the boys and the boss and those few people that had confidence in me and loved me. I didn't want them to remember me as nothing but a tongue-chewing, babbling, idiot drunk. And I said to myself, if I ever live to get out of this bed, I will find Alcoholics Anonymous. And immediately the curtain dropped. There was no more sanity. I was sick to death, drunk, and insane. And I had a lot of dying to do. But from that second until right now, I have never had a drink or a sedating or tranquilizing pill. Now, again, knows all you've done a little drinking. Know that every nerve cell in my body was screaming for liquor. But everything in me was, how long can I live without a drink? And I had a lot of dying to do, but I didn't have any drinking to do. Somehow or another, I didn't have to drink. And that is the great significance of the word called surrender. Would to God that it was possible for one of us to tell another what it means to surrender. This is the most misunderstood experience in this civilization. Surrender. For instance, I was conditioned to believe that surrender is for the weak. A strong man wins his battle, the weak man surrenders. And the word was not even in my vocabulary. If I had had to consciously surrender the first time, I would have died without coming to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's the reason that I'm so very grateful that the bottle killed me in January 1936. So I could come here and find what I've been looking for all my life. Surrender is victory for the alcoholic. When I was able to hunt for Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't know where to look for it. Again, I had made it my business to know nothing about you monkeys. And I didn't know how to find you. Now, I know you're going to be in the phone book. And incidentally, this is the story of my life. Right here is the story of my life. I knew so many things that weren't true that I couldn't find out anything that was. So I knew you wouldn't be in the phone book. You were anonymous, weren't you? So I never looked. I called people when I was well enough. I called people that I knew and asked them if they knew anybody that knew anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I finally got a telephone number from a doctor in Beverly Hills. This guy was a picture guy. I called him up. We talked a little while, and he finally said to me, "I've had a drink today." And I said, "No, sir." Well, he said, "Don't take one." He said, "I'm working nights, and I can't take you to a meeting tonight. But maybe tomorrow I can take you to a meeting. Call me tomorrow." So tomorrow I called him, and we talked a little while, and he said, "We had a drink today." And I said, "No." He says, "Don't take one. I'm still working." Call me tomorrow. So I called him again the next day, and he started that rigmarole again. And I said to him, "Oh, no, you're still working." And he said, "Yeah." I said, "You don't need to take me to meeting. Here's a meeting that I can go to." And he told me, and I went. And it was a Sunday night, just like this. The old West End group. Now, I didn't know what I was getting into. And I thought, it just might be that I shouldn't be seen with you. So I disguised me a little. I had two good garments left. I had a gray common hair top coat with a belt around the middle and a big collar. And I put that on and tied it up good and pulled that collar up around my head. I had a hat with a brim on it about that wide. Many of you have seen it. And I put that on and pulled it down over my face and sallied forth. The meeting was on the ground floor. And I got there maybe 10 minutes before it was to take up. And I looked in through the door, and there were maybe 40 men, 40 people. In the room, 35 maybe, something like that. We all from many room yapping. Every one of them talking, nobody listening. And I looked at them, and they didn't look like me, and they weren't dressed like me, and they most certainly didn't feel like me. Because this is all happy talk. And so only me, with my alcoholic mind, concluded very quickly that this is the wrong night. They gave me the wrong boat. These were the veterans and their wives, and they were there for a party. Because this is the veterans' war was held. And I knew that there were new weddings, new wives, new birthday party, and I was going to have to leave and come back the night the ducks were there. Now, if you don't think I was a dead duck when I turned to leave that place, you're mistaken. At long last, I'd tell him it was a long night. I was as near dead as I'll ever be and live when I turned to leave. And this next half minute is the essence of Alcoholics Anonymous. Without this, no recovery. Somebody had been watching me, some guy in the room. And when I came to leave, he came trotting over to the door and he called to me. And he said, "Mister, were you looking for somebody?" And I said, "No, sir." Then he says, "What are you looking for?" And thinking it was a veteran, I said to him, "If it would interest you, sir, I was looking for sobriety." And instantly, the guy changed, lit up like a Christmas tree. Everything about that man changed. And it was obvious to me that he was glad I was there. Now, this was something. This was something. Because nobody that knew me would have anything to do with me, even my own flesh and blood. And he was a stranger. But it was so glad I was there that he lit up like a Christmas tree. And between you and me, I was no bargain. I didn't come off the 4 weeks blackout. But he thought I was a bargain. He was glad I was there. And I was hooked before he ever opened his mouth again. But when he did, this is what he said. "Why, take off your hat and coat, you're in the right place." And he took me and locked me to sleep. This is very it. Without this, no recovery at all. This is the very essence of Alcoholics Anonymous. We get sober by the Spirit. We maintain sobriety by the practice of the principles. Without the Spirit, no recovery at all. Well, they told me a few things that first night that I carried for 27 years and 5 months. Number one, they told me that if I was an alcoholic, one day was too many and 1,000 wasn't enough. Now, isn't it funny? I have been drinking for 25 years, and nobody had ever told me that it was the first drink that was killing me. Nobody. And it had never occurred to me. Because, you see, I was a poor addict. And my job for the last 10 years of a 25-year drinking career was to cut it off before the trouble started. I never got them, but that time. And here this monkey comes up to pronounce me. "If you're an alcoholic, one drink's too many and 1,000 not enough." And I played with it a while and bought it. And I kept it. Because I could see it was just a question of time from that first slug after the dry spell until I sat on my back drinking the cup around again. So that happened. The second thing you told me is today's the day we don't drink. Now that's a sneaking way of keeping us coming back. Then told me I'd keep coming back for 28 years, I'd drop dead. Nobody has ever told it, 28 years. Including Glenn. But that isn't what he told me. He said, "Today's the day you don't drink." Now, I said, "There, today's too long." "How about an hour?" "How long can you live without a drink? Make that the length of your life. Live that long and start over, but don't drink." "And at no time," said Dave, "do you ever expand that time more than 24 hours. No matter how long you live in AA, that's as long as you'll ever live, 24 hours. And I bought that, and I kept it. It may be the second greatest lesson I've ever learned in my entire lifetime. This is my day. I had no past. I want no future. And if I had one message today, it would be this. For those who haven't done so, leave every yesterday and every tomorrow in this room when you leave. Leave them all right here. And you'll leave 97% of your problems. Yesterday's burdens and tomorrow's fears are the things that kill us. And if you haven't got yesterday and tomorrow, you're free. Life becomes as simple as funny when you live it 24 hours at a time. You can't even starve to death in 24 hours of the time. The lead pipe stinks. So leave every yesterday and every tomorrow in this room when we leave. And we'll leave three people. The next thing they told me was stay close to us. Get in as many meetings as you can, said they, because there is more wisdom in this room than in any other room on the face of the earth, except another room like this, where Alcoholics Anonymous members are meeting. About your problem and its answer, more wisdom in this room than any other place in the world. So stay close to us, and I've done that. I have presumed that I have come near five meetings than four per week for 27 years and 5 months. And I've never attended one 2 minutes. And you might say, how do you know? I got a very simple in words, because I never had it so good. This is the only easy life I've ever known, the only good life that's ever been mine in my entire lifetime. And the next thing you told me is why I couldn't drink like other people. And what a beautiful thing this is. This is the only intellectual knowledge you and I will ever need that we didn't have when we came through the door the first time. Why we can't drink like other people. Because this is not a program of great intellect, neither is it a program of great ability. It's a program of attitude and effort. So it's a beautiful thing to know why we can't drink like other people. Everybody who stays with me for 10 years, Chuck, you can't drink, you got to quit. And in 99 cases out of 100, it was obvious to me that the guy that was saying that was my inferior. I'd look at the pipsqueak, and I'd say to myself, why in the hell can I drink? He does. And my answer is, you can't, and you got to prove it. And I'm still trying to prove it 10 years after I'd left. And nobody ever told me why I couldn't drink like other people. I went to many people in that last 10 years. Doctors, priests, preachers, psychiatrists. People knew more psychiatry than there is. And one of them talked to me about no power backbone standing up being a man. And the longer I live, the more tickled I get over this stuff. This is amazing. I knew that they were wrong. I didn't know what was right, but I knew that they were wrong. I was born with a pitchfork in my hand. I worked all my life. And I was quite an athlete in my day. And I can say that because there's nobody here that remembers that far back. And you know something? My backbone had never given me a particle of trouble. It had always been adequate. And still is. I never had any trouble with my backbone. I wish everything I had worked as well as my backbone. That's it. All right. So I knew I wasn't deficient in backbone. And willpower, this just tickled the bejesus out of me. If there was ever a bunch of people that got willpower, it's the alcoholics of the land. Every time I hear earth people talking about willpower, I want to ask them one little question. How many of you ever crawled a mile in the mud after dark just to get a bucket of ice? Yeah. It's good for a runner. Without willpower, I could get liquor and candies on election day if it fell on Sunday. Depended only on how high I was walking off the sidewalk, how long it took. So I knew that willpower was not my problem. And in the standing up and doing the man department, we can give them cards and spades. Talk about your philosophers of the world. We got them. We have always known what is wrong with everybody else in the world but us. And the thing that endeared us to the non-alcoholic girl was that we didn't mind having a party with them. And that is not a good way to win friends and influence people. So I knew that they didn't have the answer for me. I didn't know the answer, but I knew they didn't have it. And nobody ever told me that I got in my first meeting. And people just like you, drunks who were not drunk, told me the first night, why can't I successfully go record? Because I'm an alcoholic. What is an alcoholic? An alcoholic is a person who suffers with the disease of alcoholism. I had never heard that phrase until I got to my first meeting. Nobody had ever used it in my presence, as far as I knew. You told me the first night. Now, I have remained with you to find that, from the medical standpoint, informed doctors label our disease second. Now, they used to say in the top four. Now they say second is killer. Second as a killer in the United States. It's also second as a cause for permanent insanity. And medically speaking, it's incurable. And that's what I got. It's a matter of life or death, and it's my life. Now, we got our definition of disease from a doctor, too. They say that Silky attended not less than 40,000 alkies during his practicing medical lifetime. And he labeled this thing a disease of a twofold nature, an allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. It's both physical and mental. I am different physically and mentally than the guy or gal that drinks socially. And this is an awful good thing to know. Now, nobody knows what the allergy of the body is. What's different about my body? Nobody knows. They've been researching this thing for a long time, but nobody's come up with the answer. They don't know what's different about my body. They know there's something different, because they can test me and see, but they don't know what it is. So we spend no time on that. But a couple of things about the physical part of the disease are very necessary that I remember always. Number one, once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. There's not a case in medical history where anybody like me ever returned to successful drinking. That's something I must forever keep uppermost in my consciousness. Secondly, the physical part of the disease gets worse with the passage of time, even during all the extended period of total abstinence. Now, this is tough for us, too, because when an alcoholic gets a little distance between him and the drug, their subconscious starts telling us, you're building up some good drinking time. You're getting strong. You're building up some good drinking time. There's no such thing as an alcoholic building up good drinking time. I'm actually 27 years worse off so far as successfully drinking liquor is concerned than I was when I got here. And I know it, and I don't have to take a drink to prove it. Why? Because I've been close to and active in this program for 27 years. And all you got to do when you're close to an active is keep your eyes open. Because your friends are forever taking that drink for you, and you don't have to take it, just watch them. You'll have to watch a lot of them die. A lot of them you really want to watch die, but you still have to do it. And it's a pretty rough lesson, but it's very effective. I've never caught myself one time in 27 years toying with the idea that maybe I could handle a little light wine and beer. Not once in this whole time. And lastly, there's no cure for the body. If we had all the money in California, it wouldn't be enough to send one out of someplace to get a body's made over so we could drink. So we accept that fact and turn to the other half of the disease. The obsessions of the mind that cause us to drink. When the body is totally dry, there is no physical demand for liquor. The first drink is mental. The second drink and the 542nd drink are physical, but the first one's mental. And if you and I want to live without drinking, if we'd be alcoholic, we have to be aware of the cause of our drinking, the obsessions of the mind. And that's what our program is all about. It's designed and put together and proven as a way to rid ourselves of the obsessions of the mind. And all you and I have to do is to fulfill the conditions of the formula. How many times have you heard people say, I tried Alcoholics Anonymous, it didn't work for me? Of course I didn't. I never asked anybody and never will. Formulas don't do anything. They're ready to do something. And our formula is the best formula that was ever conceived in the mind of man by the grace of God. For an alcoholic to obtain and maintain sobriety. All you now need do is to fulfill the conditions of the formula. And the first condition is carried out in chapter 3. It's the first paragraph of the first line in the second paragraph of chapter 2. And it says, we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. Now, why is that said back in chapter 3? The steps will come to chapter 5. And it's at the first part of chapter 3. It's there because if we be alcoholic, we're caught in a trap we can't spring. We have to have help. And there's no way that we can get help until we recognize the need for help. No way. We have to accept ourselves exactly as we are, where we are right now, in order to open that door. For instance, on my next to the last drink, I had a little geographic. I drove 6,000 miles in a blackout. I drove Louisville, Kentucky, North Michigan, and back to the coast. And you don't remember 5% of it. The 5% of it's very interesting. I don't know why I'm 5% about it. I got back to the coast and went to bed and finished my drink. Now I'm finishing my drink, that means that I drank until I couldn't even lift my head off the pillow to look for another bottle. When that time came, I had to get sober. When that time came. Maybe in the 24 or 36 hours after my last drink, I was able to get up and go to the kitchen for a glass of buttermilk. Which I did. Mrs. C and Dick were sitting in the living room. They heard me let out a bellow and heard me hit the floor. They came running out expecting to find me in an alcoholic convulsion, which was my want. But I wasn't convulsing. I was just lying there on the kitchen floor as peaceful as anybody ever saw. I wasn't doing nothing. I was a funny color. I was blue. And they couldn't wake me up. And they got all exercised. Called the oxygen squad to Baylor Hills Receiving Hospital to come down and see if they could do anything about it. And I got to make a comment on this. I'll hurry. How many times I came off the drunk to find that everybody that knew me was looking for me. 90% of them just tell me they never wanted to see me again. Now, why in the hell do they have to throw this out? But anyway, just to tell us they never want to see us again. And I'm sure my wife and kids have been praying for me to die for 5 years. And they come out of the kitchen and find me dead. And they get exercise and call the oxygen squad. And they came down and I think they woke me up. I remember what happened after I came to. There was a young doctor with them. And he was telling me to all intents and purposes I'd been dead. He said they had a bad time bringing me around, and he said that it was their opinion that nobody would ever bring me back again under those circumstances. And he told me very seriously, if I were you, I wouldn't do that anymore. I knew immediately that they were in it. Well, maybe it's another 24 hours, 36 maybe. When I was able to get the old lady bathrobe on and started walking off this dump. That's the only way I ever knew to get sober. I never heard of a drying out place till I got the AA. And I've never had to dry out since I came. I always died until I could live. And I didn't know you were walking. Here I'm walking up and down the living room. Sweating, freezing, shaking, dying and walking. Mrs. C standing over the fireplace. And I'm walking away from her, and she says, Chuck, don't you think you might get a little help if you read the book Alcoholics Anonymous? And she might as well have hit me with a ball bat. I turned on her and said, you, my very own wife, suggesting that I read a book written by a bunch of drunks. I have read all the good books to the good authors, and you want me, well, I said, you wound me deeply. Now, I've just been dead 48 hours before, and she wounded me deeply. And I polished her off completely by saying, besides, I can write a better book than that myself. Excuse me, parents. Now, that was just 90 days before I came calling in this program. Just 90 days. I'd already been drinking for 25 years. And she wounded me deeply just by telling me that maybe I'd get some help reading the book. We can't hear what we can hear, and we can't see what we can see. Something has got to happen. The next condition is in chapter 5, but it too is before the cross steps. And it reads like this. If you have decided you want what you have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. So that makes sobriety number one. And I'm one who believes that unless and or until sobriety becomes number one, we can't have it. And unless it remains number one, we can't keep it. One of two things I believe has to happen to us. Either we have to drink the last dregs out of the bottom of the cup, and that's the way it happened to me. Or we have to come to see that there's nothing ahead of us but permanent insanity or an alcoholic death. Or we will not take step one. No alcoholic can walk up to step one and take it until something's happened. Until he recognizes the need for help, and until sobriety is tops in his life. Because step one is a two-fold admission of defeat. We admitted that we were powerless over alcohol, physical, that our lives had become unmanageable, mental. I've lost the body of life twice over, physically and mentally. Number two is worse than number one. Because it's a left-handed admission that you're nuts. It reads, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Now there's an implication here. Same people don't need to be restored to sanity. If you and I need to be restored to sanity, we're nuts. So number one, we've lost the battle. Number two, we're not. And that's pretty fast going for drunk. And as tough as they are, number three is worse than both of them. Because number three says you've got to give up the keys. Now listen, the serious you go, they're taking a new death. The only way anybody ever could get my keys is to wait till I passed out. We don't give up keys, you know. I can come out of the pub at 3 o'clock in the morning with my wife or yours. We'd head to the parking lot and she'd try to give me the keys. I'd ride and say, whose car? Whose car are you going to drive? This is my car. If we're going to be given. Well, you might be there daylight. You ain't going no place, but you still got the keys. Number three says we got to get a new driver. We made a decision to turn our own lives over to God. This is the most fabulous thing on the face of the earth. You see, we've lost the battle. We need help. We're nuts. Now we can make a decision to turn our own lives over to some power, maybe that can help us. Fabulous thing was, did it ever occur to you that if I turn my will and my life over to God, There is no further room for self-concern. Is that the thinking? Self-concern is nothing new, but say, look, Dad, I don't believe you're quite as familiar with this problem as I am. I gotta get you some outside help. There's a beautiful saying in Australia. It's in the literature, and they talk about it a great deal. And it's this. The measure of your anxiety is the measure of your distance from God. Isn't that a beauty? The measure of your anxiety is the measure of your distance from God. We made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. Now, if I do that, the only will I can have from now on is the will to be His will. That's the only will I can have, the will to be God's will. I wish I could go through the rest of the steps, but I can't, because I want to talk about this for a little bit, and then I'll let you off the hook. Reluctantly. You know, this is one of the bad things about longevity in this program. You can never get done. You know, you never get what you want to say said. You can go from now to Christmas. You never get done. So I'm going to bail out and quit without getting done. Can you imagine a tongue-chewing, babbling, idiot drunk with a personally acceptable, conscious partnership with the living God that made him in the entire business of living? Now, this has been my position for the last 27 years and 5 months. You see, I had 33 years to run my life. I gave it everything I had. All my wit and wisdom I put in this back. And at the ripe old age of 33, I was a failure as a husband, a father, a businessman, a man, and a drunk. I've given it everything I had. My wife, my kids, our home, my job, my health, my sanity, and my money. And I lost. So you see, I have known from that day in January 1946 until right now that I can't run anything. I had my day, and I lost. But that makes no difference to me. Because you see, I have step 11. So through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with my very own God, praying only for knowledge of His will for me in the past year. Without that step, I would have been dead 27 years ago. I had depended totally on step 11 for 27 years for guidance and direction. I have simplified it a great deal. I like to think of it like this. I get up in the morning and I say, look, Dad, I'm reporting for duty. Now I'm going to move it around. I'm going to do the best thing we ever got. And all I want out of you is a little guidance and direction if I had to go about. Sure, thank you. I'm going to go about my business. Whatever there is to do, I'll go about it, doing the best I can. Expecting guidance and direction. And I get it. And you might say, how do you know? And again, I have to tell you, my yardstick is thousands with me. And I never had it so good. So this is quite a thing. It's a fabulous thing. Now, in step 12, we're given a lifetime job. From now on, our operation is outlined for us. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. We tried to carry this message to alcoholics. and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. And to practice these principles in all of our affairs. That means home, business, play, AA, church, if you've got one. In all of our affairs. Now this is all I've done for 27 years. And I want to tell you, it's a little series of awakenings that have come, and now in conclusion of why they came. I attended meetings for 6 months, a meeting every night of the week, with a great fear upon me that we couldn't have this thing. Because I didn't think I had enough left physically and mentally to get it. And to emphasize that for just a second, it took me 3.5 years to get over falling on my face after my last drunk. That's kind of a body I brought with me. It took me over 6 months to put the serenity prayer together in English, not spiritually, in English. I couldn't make it make sense. And that's the kind of a mind I brought, that I wanted this thing more than life. And I was here every night of the week for 6 months, and I discovered that I was sober, and had been for 6 months. Not a drink or a pill from my first meeting. As a matter of fact, from before I got here, from my decision, from my commitment to find the program and go right now. Now that was quite a discovery. Incidentally, it was then that I started talking, and I haven't shut up yet. And for your own information, I'm not going to. And while I'm on this subject, I've got to say one more thing, and this won't take long. A friend of mine came in about the same time I did, some time back. Said to me, Chuck, he says, I'll quit working with wet drunks. He says, I've done my stint. He says, you'll let the youngsters do it from now on. And he says, besides, I'm tired of getting too close. He says, how about you? And I said, well, I'll probably keep right on working with wet drunks until they pat me in the face and scoop. I sort of like to work with wet drunks. And I said, besides, I'd a hell of a lot rather be the few peas than the few cars. And there's one more thing that I got to cover before running away. The face of the society has changed completely for the better. When I came, some of them were older than I was when they came. They were similarly old men, maybe about 7 women when I got here. And that's changed. Now, I talk with many groups where the women alcoholics are even with, outnumber us. And that's a great improvement, I think. And in the next place, they get younger, all the time younger. In my day, I think the average was 50. About 50. And now I thought that maybe there'd be 225 people, and the average age would not exceed 30. And incidentally, I sat with a kid the other day at a meeting. There was 90 days without a drink. He was 12 years old. A confirmed alcoholic at 12. So they're getting younger, thank God. But many of these youngsters say to me, Chuck, you couldn't possibly remember how I feel.
You've been sober long enough to be alive.
Yes, Jason. You can't possibly remember how I feel. And I say maybe I can. Because I'm convinced clear through that you can't get any older than your last session with a wet drunk. If you're working with a wet drunk, you can't get old in this thing. There's no way that you can spend a night with a weapon and not have everything that ever went through you, every pain and every fear and everything else go through you again. You relive it with them all the time. And by working with wet drunks, we're continuously taking a fourth step. We don't have to go back and take that over 4,000 times. Because it's a continuous thing, because every new situation we get in reminds us of another something in our own life that we share with them. So if you're missing working with wet drunks, you're missing the greatest joy that there is in Alcoholics Anonymous. I highly recommend it. Now the next discovery was that something happened in the household. This might have been another 6 months. And I discovered something had happened in the household. It seemed like the world was over. They took care of me with a blue paper. And that was a beautiful discovery. It was fantastic. It seemed like a whole bunch of them were living like a bunch of kittens. And this was real good. And another 6 months went by, and I discovered that I was still down there trying to clean up the desk at the office. Now, I'd gone down there before I got in an AA meeting because I had to. You see, he had paid me for something I hadn't done. And I knew he was going to tell me through the window, but I couldn't help it. I had to go down there because I had to get even with him. And he came in and told me through the window. And I could have done nothing about it. I couldn't even shout it. You can't shoot when you... Not only a gentleman, but you can't see. And all I could do is say, Victor, leave me alone. Don't work for you anymore. I'm down here to clean up this desk. I'm here to do the things you paid me for last year that didn't do. As soon as I get even with you, I'll get the hell out of here in my own power. And you'll never owe me a penny as long as you live, but for God's sake, leave me alone. I've got to get even with you. And he stopped his tracks, and he said, what the hell happened to you, Charlie? And I said, don't know. And it was 2 years later that I discovered I was still down there trying to clean up my desk. And business was good. Business was plumb good. And another maybe a year went by, and I discovered that the state of my own being was better than anything I'd ever known. Life was really beautiful. And that was a good discovery. And maybe 5 years, 6 years have gone by now. And I made the great discovery. And I wrote that I'm never alone anymore. I have a God of my very own, and wherever I am, He is. And this is the great discovery. When we make this discovery, the search is over and life begins. And in my book, it's an inside job. It's an inside job. The whole business is an inside job. In Alcoholics Anonymous, we uncover and discover the thing we've had to have since the day we were born. Uncover and discover. In the first 9 steps of our program, we are squeezed out of ourselves. If we get here without being surrendered, the first 9 steps will surrender. If we do them honestly, we are surrendered at number 10. Then, with better honesty, we can look deep within ourselves and find us, which improves our relationship to each other and to God. It's a fantastic thing. uncovering, discovering, and describing. And from then on, we are discarding the things that we were conditioned to believe were true about this thing called life that are absolutely contrary to our living experience. It's like going up in a balloon. You get up to here and stop. And you have to throw over some ballast. And you go on up here and stop. And you throw over some ballast. And you go on up here. And it'll be that way forever. We'll always be discarding the things that we were conditioned to believe were true about life that aren't true at all. For instance, if any book on earth said this was a getting life, and every authority said it was a getting life, I'd laugh out loud. Because I know better. By the accident of total failure, it was necessary for me to try to clean up the areas that I'd been so badly with. And the two of them were the home and the business. And I started trying to rub out a record at home and at business. Nothing else, just to rub out a record. And you can't rub out a record thinking, I want, I don't want, I like, I don't like, I will, I. If you're going to rub out a record, you got to do something for somebody without a price tag on it. And that's all I've done for 27 years. Every part of my life for 27 years has been one 12-step call. In business, at home, at play, the works. Just trying to help God's kids do things that they need to have done because I want to. Now, businessmen say that cannot be done. They looked at me for 25 years, right across the desk, and they'd look me right in the eye and say, Chuck, you're a goddamn liar. And I just laughed. I didn't even try to talk with anybody. Because I knew better. You see, I knew what I was doing, and I knew what was happening. And so I found out by doing it that St. Francis knew what he was talking about. When he said, for it is in giving that we receive. In forgiving that we are forgiven. And in dying to self that we awaken to eternal life. It's an inside job. Now I'm going to quote a couple of Catholics. And I can, because I don't have to be Catholic. You can't tell me I came all the way up here to the Northern Area Council and laid Catholicism on you. Because I don't happen to be Catholic, but I love them pretty good. And these two are just two that I love exceptionally well. I mentioned one of them before, Brother Lawrence. Brother Lawrence was just an ordinary brother. He wasn't even a priest. He was a Carmelite. He lived back in 1666. And he was a pot and pan washer in the monastery. He's back there in the corner washing pots and pans. Said everybody was yelling for something different all the time, and he didn't pay attention to him. He just went ahead and talked to God. Didn't know when his prayers of office started and stopped, when his prayers began. I like that. And he was working with one of his troubled friends one time. And he said to him, if you would find God, look deep within yourself. Because it's the only place you're ever going to find him. If you would find God, look deep within yourself, because it's the only place you're ever going to find him. Then there was another guy, he was a Dominican priest, and he lived in Germany about the same time. And he said it like this, you have heard that nature abhors a vacuum. I tell you that God abhors a vacuum and can't abide a vacuum any place under heaven, however small. Now, if you see, all you got to do is move out. Get empty of self. And automatically, you're full of God. Now that comes merely explaining my experience in bed in January 1946 and anything I ever heard, read, or saw. But it's not so different from what the carpenter said. He said, I'm the father, he and me, and I knew. That's pretty close. Pretty close. It's almost too close to find. I think the great cosmic joke is that God heard himself in the last place we ever looked. And that's right here. So, again, in my book, this is an inside job. I think that every person sitting in front of me right now and these few that are behind me are a total, complete, going concern within yourself. Not because you're so hot, but because of the implication in the first two words of the Lord's Prayer. Our Father. Our Father God. Remember when they said the carpenter master teaches to pray? He said, after this manner pray ye, our Father, his Father, your Father, and mine. Now, if there's one thing that living with people like you for 27 years has convinced me from the soles of my feet to the top of my longest hair, it's that these two words mean exactly what they say. Our Father, God. Now, if God's our Father, we're his kids. And if this be true, you can let your imagination go crazy. And you can't even get close to the truth of being itself. It's the most fantastic thing on the face of the earth. And I am totally convinced that it's true. I am totally convinced that God has always known that you and I were his kids. But we didn't know, and we had to find out. We had to discover it for ourselves. And being alcoholic, we had to do it in our own way and in our own time. Because, you see, we are not people who take well to authority. They tell us, do thus and so, and we say, who said so? And they say, well, it's written right here, and we say, who wrote it? So we had to find out in our own way, in our own time. Now, I'm totally convinced that God loved me just as much when I sat in the chair that I sit in right now for 10 years in hell. When I sat there with absolutely nothing going for me, not even 2 coppers to rub together. No home, no job, no nothing, including sanity. I was his kid, and he knew it, but I didn't. He loved me just as much as he does now. But he didn't keep me from making mistakes. He loved me enough to allow me to make my own mistakes that I might the sooner run out of my own resources and come back home where I belong. It's not normal for us to be away from the Father's house. It's not normal for us to walk alone. It's normal to walk down the high road of life like we do now with our arms around each other. Sharing our experience, strength, and hope one with another in love. This is normal as breathing. It's not normal to be away from home. We're like kids who are lost in the woods. It's normal to be totally dependent on this great thing called God. To be consciously aware that every good and perfect gift is from his hand. And in order to express my gratitude for you and for this program, I've spent many hours trying to figure out what I might do to show my gratitude. And the only thing I can come up with is what I'm doing right now. To go about my Father's business in the only way I know how. And that is to help his kids do things they need to have done because I want to. And I'm convinced that that's my business, and just as convinced that it's his business to take care of me. And again, how do I know? I never had it so good. God bless you. Thank you very much.